Welcome to the review of Democracy, the journal of the CEU Democracy Institute, where we discuss some of the most exciting new publications concerning the past, present, and future of democracies across the globe. I am Ferenc Lotso, and it is my special pleasure to host Maximilian Hess today. Welcome to the show, Max, and thanks so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to chatting with you.
Great to have you at the Review of Democracy. Maximilian Hess is the founder of the political risk consultancy Enmetena Advisory, a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, an associate fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and the Oxus Society for Central Asian Affairs. His research focuses on the relationship between trade, debt, international relations, and foreign policy, as well as the overlap between political and economic networks. Max has just published a fascinating new book titled Economic War: Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West, which will serve as the basis of our conversation today. Now, an obvious place for us to start might be to ask you, Max, what gave rise to this major geo-economic competition between Russia and the West in our times? Why has such an economic war broken out?
Great. Well, firstly, I think it's important to highlight that just as the war in Ukraine didn't begin in February 2022, but actually began in February of 2014, the economic war has also been ongoing for nine and even more years. It also, after the full-scale invasion last year, reached a certain new level, one that is unprecedented in the post-World War II era, which, you know, I'm sure we'll discuss more later. But, you know, I think what actually began this economic war was really a series of misunderstandings between Russia and the West and mutually escalatory steps. And in large part because we don't see economic conflict traditionally in the same lens that we view military conflict, both sides' escalation ladders didn't take into account the other side's relative escalation ladder. I trace the beginning in the book of this economic war all the way back to 2013, when Russia at the time was seeking to keep Ukraine in its sphere of influence. Yanukovych, the then president of Ukraine, who was ultimately ousted in the Maidan Revolution in February 2014, was seeking ways to hold on to power. And although Putin had put Ukraine under sanctions and a trade blockade and in 2013 to try to pressure Yanukovych into the Eurasian Economic Union rather than joining or signing a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union, that ultimately Putin bailed out Yanukovych through a very unique financing arrangement using what's called a euro bond, which is traditionally an instrument of the private markets to bail out Ukraine, but also to keep it in effectively a form of debt trap diplomacy because of the unique terms of this loan. It was supposed to be $15 billion in such loans. Only $3 billion were agreed before was then effectively canceled as a result of the revolution in Kyiv. But then the West began to respond with sanctions that were meant to deter Russia, but which Russia saw as an abuse of the US in particular's leading position in the international economic order. Now, this is not a view that I subscribe to, but you know, it's important to state that for Putin, this would have begun a year earlier, with at the time the passage of the initial Magnitsky Act in legislation that was actually meant to normalize Russian U.S. relations in the aftermath of the so-called reset in 2009. And, you know, there's a quote that Putin gave to some journalists that I highlight in the book that I think is very important. Putin lashed out at this, although it was the Magnitsky sanctions at that point were really only a response to the expropriation of a business owned by Bill Browder, a Western and American investor who'd been in Russia for a long time, and the murder of his one of his lawyers during that process. Putin came and said, they're slapping us in the face. They're effectively abusing their position. If we don't do something about this, they'll keep on doing it for forever. And so for Putin, you know, know, although that's not to say that the international economic order was the primary motivation for his decision to annex Crimea in 2014 and foment the conflict in Donbas that began shortly thereafter. But for Putin, the future of Ukraine and the future of the international economic order have been tied together since not only 2014, but arguably 2013 or maybe even 2012. And I think that we failed to see how he understood these things. And Putin then in turn failed to see the West's intentions with its own sanctions regime that really began in that summer after the annexation of Crimea in 2014.
Thank you so much. That's a really excellent introduction to the subject. Could I also ask you to discuss how Russia's really truly modest economic ambitions since have changed the country's internal functioning? How have they altered its economic connections and position internationally since the early 2010s?
Yes. So, you know, the first half of the book attempts to lay out how this conflict became such a truly global one. And some of that has to do with the global nature of markets. That was a particular impact in 2022 with gas markets having finally reached a global stage, but also as the result of Putin seeking alternative partners and allies to help him challenge the US-led international economic order in that time. So we saw the development of the BRICS Bank, as it was originally called, the New Development Bank, attempts to build new relations with China in terms of seeking financing to secure key oil partnerships around the world. So from India's second largest refinery that was invested in by Rosneft, the Russian state oil company, to what I view as sort of the most successful part of Putin's geoeconomic agenda in the 8 years between 2014 and 2022, which is the alliance of OPEC plus with Saudi Arabia. So I think, you know, people often talk about Trump's relationship, for example, with MBS and coming for critical, you know, takes there. But in my view, you know, the U.S. got completely hoodwinked. The true story of those years is not about the U.S.-Saudi partnership changing under MBS and Trump, but the U.S.-Russian partnership. And, you know, one of the points that I highlight there is the famous Trump visit, where his first visit abroad was to Riyadh, dancing with the swords and the famous orb, you know, that made sort of nice photos for media outlets all around the world. That at the same time, this is while MBS was solidifying his energy alliance with Putin. And then other countries around the world also played various roles, with Russia, for example, seeking to gain a foothold in the energy market in the Western Hemisphere through its partnership with Venezuela, hoping to build oil and gas resources there, but also ultimately experimenting with some sanctions mitigation tools, such as, you know, fruitlessly, to be honest, but nevertheless trying to build up a cryptocurrency system there that could mitigate the pain of sanctions. That's something we've still seen Russia fail to introduce. And other efforts across Southeast Asia in particular, and also in Africa, which have gotten a lot of attention recently through, of course, the Wagner Group and in the aftermath of Yevgeny Prigozhin's death. Although in my view, from a macro level, a lot of the activity in Africa was unsuccessful in large part because the gold and other resources that Wagner got were not used to help the Kremlin build up its fortress balance sheet strategy. And in the Kremlin's sort of geoeconomically and, in my view, geopolitically most, you know, significant attempts to gain a foothold in Africa actually came in Mozambique, where Wagner had a major failure and was kicked out of the country rather swiftly after being invited in, after getting into a fight with the Mozambican security forces and failing to protect the gas infrastructure in the north of the country that, once again, the Rosneft was seeking to take a leading role in. So, you know, the ultimate cumulative effect of this sort of spread of the conflict around the world was that, you know, the macroeconomic impacts of the full-scale war in 2022 were exponentially greater than the macroeconomic impacts of the initial war and the initial wave of sanctions in 2014.
Great. That's what I think we should try to zoom in a bit more. Let me ask it in a very general way. Why has Russia's large-scale invasion and really brutal attempt to wreck Ukraine since early 2022 caused such a major disruption on the global scale?
Firstly, I think, you know, part of the timing with Putin's invasion is that he thought it was at a point where the West would be particularly susceptible to his economic pressures. We saw that not only with Russia's gas politics throughout 2022, but with Russia already putting Europe under pressure in the end of 2021, inventing rather fictitious reasons to turn down gas shipments at various points via Nord Stream or via the Yamal Europe pipelines and other networks. And of course, it came at a time where inflation was already picking up as a result of the exit from COVID. And inflation, you know, as I think had often been forgotten, but has been made exceptionally clear over the last 18 months, is something that is politically very painful for governments and that is economically particularly painful for not just big corporations. In fact, for big corporations, it may be less painful, but for your everyman, your voter, you know, when the value of the currency in your pocket literally declines, that is something that affects almost everybody except for perhaps the, you know, true billionaire class in the world. And so I think for Putin, you know, in the timing of when he launched the war was one that he saw would be but misjudged, that he would be able to drive the West further apart. And then secondly, you know, the reason why it was in part so painful is not just the geographic spread of this conflict, but really Europe's and some country in Europe's in particular's failure to understand the costs, benefits, and threats of interdependence. So Germany is always held up as the country par excellence, but certainly was a very large trend of French, Austrian, Italian, even British politics as well, in terms of foolishly pursuing this economic interdependence strategy. And I'll just use Germany as it's the most straightforward example. You know, it wasn't just the Gerhard Schröder, the former German chancellor, who has, you know, since disgraced himself through his association with Russian state energy companies and visits to Putin even after the war. But, you know, something that was very much across the political spectrum, including, you know, his erstwhile rival, Angela Merkel, the long-serving chancellor, who saw economic interdependence as something that they could use to blunt Russia's threat. And of course, you know, Germany has its own experience with this, going back to the Cold War, going back to, you know, essentially the construction of the first pipelines between the West and the Soviet bloc into Germany in the 1970s and 1980s, that, you know, very much accompanied the Ostpolitik of the time in lowering tensions there. But, you know, while this is certainly not to defend the dictatorial nature of the Soviet regime, you know, I do think that, in fact, certainly the late Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s was in some ways even more responsive to its citizenry than Putin is today. And one of the key points that, you know, I make that I think Europe failed to understand is, you know, despite headline GDP figures recovering after 2014, when they did very badly, in part also due to the global oil crisis that year, is that, you know, Russian living standards and the basket of goods that they've been able to afford has never gone back to their 2013 levels. And, you know, we see now how willing Putin is to turn Russia's economy into effectively a new North Korea, or at least Iran, if one is sort of more generous, in exchange for his imperial vision, regardless of what, whether it be business elites or the average Russian on the street thinks of that. And so I think there was a big failing in the European strategy of thinking that interdependence was something that would work on the Kremlin, which is, you know, not democratically accountable, and also, you know, even non-democratically accountable states, if they, you know, put their economic considerations ahead of their imperial ones, interdependence can matter. But for Putin's Kremlin, that has certainly long not been the case. And he has put his imperial ambitions above his economic ones for, at least in terms of the Russian domestic economy, for a long time. Russia sees the US-led international economic order as its own kind of empire. So when he challenges that, it's not to boost Russia's economy, but to weaken the West's.
Great. How would you compare the European response in the years 2013 to 2021 to the European response since early 2022? And how would you assess these two responses?
I mean, you know, overall, it's night and day. Europe was extremely hesitant to pursue any kind of serious sanctions after 2014. They dragged their feet on the major sanctions innovation then, which were so-called sectoral sanctions targeting Russia's oil sector, financing for that sector and its military as well, and only came on board with them after, you know, a personal plea by the then Dutch foreign minister after the tragedy of the shootdown of MH17. Over eastern Ukraine, which just last year, rightfully so, a Dutch court found the Russian state to be responsible for, as well as three Russian commanders who it had deployed to the Donbas, where the fighting was taking place at that time in eastern Ukraine. Whereas, you know, after 2022, and you know, especially now, Europe's support has proven to be united and sustainable, and really a realization that the short-term economic pain that it has to accept is better than the long-term threat of further Russian military aggression and economic aggression against those countries. Certainly as long as Putin is in power and his regime is around, I think it's pretty clear to most of Europe, one or two notable exceptions there, although their opposition is mostly rhetorical rather than real, have come to accept that is a cost that has to be borne and that Russia can't be there. And we just got some data from the Kiel Institute in Germany yesterday that European economic and financial support are meant to overtake U.S. financial support pledged so far. Some of that is because that European financial support is for Ukraine is over very long terms. But we've also seen Europe, fully on board with the sanctions agenda since the EU undertaking its own innovations to help give us more of a secondary sanctions threat to European sanctions, mimicking some of the effective practices of the United States and making clear that there's, sort of no wiggle room between them. And then also in Europe's role in bringing the G7 on board and other countries like Singapore, South Korea, that didn't join the sanctions regime in 2014, but now are supporting it, I think is in large part due to their position in it and the fact that it's not just seen by those countries as a U.S. versus Russia.
Your book also reflects on how the respective relationships between Russia and China on the one hand and between the US and the EU on the other have been changing. So what have been the major implications of the economic war when it comes to these two crucial relationships?
Yeah. So first I'll answer about China and then I'll move on to the West because I think they're related issues. It wasn't a month before the full-scale invasion that Xi and Putin were declaring limitless friendship. Whereas I think that this war has proven that it is at best a partnership with very strong limits. And I would say the clearest way to see that is to look at, strategically, what does Putin want from China on both the military and the economic front? And there's three things, right? He wants direct as much support as possible for the war. Secondly, he wants a deal to build the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline, which they actually said that they had agreed at that same Limitless Friendship Summit just a few weeks before the full-scale invasion. And of course, with the original Power of Siberia pipeline, the gas pipeline from Russia to China having been agreed in just a few months after the 2014 invasion. And then thirdly, he wants the Chinese financial market to both provide credit for Russian companies to replace their lack of access to Western markets, but also to help Russia limit the pain of Western sanctions on its monetary system and trade abilities. So really the use of the renminbi and its networks to facilitate trade internationally. We've even seen Putin directly ask for that with regards to African countries and China and Beijing softly say no. So the three things that Putin wants from Beijing most, he hasn't gotten. Certainly Beijing is not against Russia, but it's not willing to support it either. And this is because the way I see things is one of the key distinctions is between this economic war and trade wars, right? We've obviously had a trade war between the United States and China going on for around 7 years now. But the trade war is really about the spoils of the international economic order. China wants to be number one. replacing the U.S.'s current position, whereas Russia wants to actively destroy the international economic order. So I think for now, Beijing sees Moscow as more of a threat than an opportunity to its agenda. And, you know, I'm not saying that everything about, you know, the Chinese government's economic agenda or political agenda is not a threat. You know, certainly Taiwan is a concern. Of course, the erosion of what democratic practices there were in Hong Kong is horrible. A true tragedy in Xinjiang with the genocide of the Uyghurs and the creation of camps there to re-educate them, as Beijing says. But, you know, China's sets up its Belt and Road program, loans mostly in dollars. It sets up its own arbitration institutes and bilateral investment treaties, the sort of core institutions behind the international economic order. It just wants them to be based in China rather than in Washington, D.C. and in Europe. Putin, on the other hand, really wants to destroy this order. Now, the fact that the West has come so strongly together in the aftermath of the full-scale invasion is really important for this, because it's exactly where we see the limits to some of the efforts where they do cooperate, such as BRICS, right? So, you know, we spoke briefly about the New Development Bank, this one institution to come out of the BRICS framework in the 8 years between the 2014 invasion and the full-scale invasion in 2022. And even the BRICS Bank, now known as the New Development Bank, has suspended its loans in Russia because of how hegemonic the U.S. influence is over the international economic order. But, you know, Beijing hasn't publicly denounced that. And at the most recent BRICS summit in South Africa, although we saw talk of, you know, accepting new members, there was no sort of way to get around this. And of course, Putin himself couldn't travel there because of the International Criminal Court and its warrant against him for the war crimes in relation to the stealing of Ukrainian children from occupied territory. You know, the reason why I think BRICS can't be successful, and one of the points that they dropped from that summit entirely, although it was the main one that Putin and the Russian state media had been pushing for, was this creation of an alternative BRICS currency to replace the dollar. And, you know, we had various statements from Lula, the Brazilian president, about it as well, and it's sort of being a goal. But the real reality of it is to create a currency system that can challenge the dollar anytime soon. You know, that's not to say the dollar doesn't have its own threats internally, which we can talk about and which have made some news recently with the debt ceiling and the like. But is all those countries that are core BRICS members now, right? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa is a little different because of its ongoing economic crisis. They're all mass surplus earning countries, right? They all have run trade surpluses. So what they effectively have is they need markets to export and invest their capital abroad. And the two great deficit markets in the world are the United States and Europe. So without a willingness in one of those two markets to do more with an alternative currency and to accept it, it's basically going to be impossible to have any kind of real new BRICS-backed currency run it, especially as long as China still has closed capital controls, meaning there's no, you know, if you are a Chinese national, it is not as easy as it is in the West. It's, you know, send your savings abroad, for example. So as a result of that, you know, the sort of limitations of this new alternate international economic order that Russia likes to talk about are very constrained. And this is where I get frustrated when people talk about BRICS and the like is this new alternative, is that, you know, efforts have been going on to challenge the U.S. hegemony over the international economic order for more than 50 years. And in 1974, there was a resolution passed by the UN General Assembly, led by at the time the non-aligned countries, calling for exactly such a new international economic order. And it never went anywhere. I'm not saying that U.S. hegemony over that order is always a good thing, and sometimes it abuses its position, you know, in my view, and therefore serves as its own worst enemy. But the BRICS is one of the weaker efforts that we've seen to do this, especially with Russia at the helm and in no position to lead. So, you know, I think that renewed alliance and that renewed political cooperation between Europe and the United States in particular is something that China will have seen as a huge folly of Putin's in launching this war, and that he has set back some of their own efforts to reshape the international economic order rather than destroy it, that he has set them back through this war. That's not to say Beijing will always have that opinion. If the West falters and starts fighting amongst itself and certain European countries, the United States give up on the sanctions agenda and their own parts of the economic war because they see the short-term costs as too significant, I think that the long-term costs that they will bear from that will be far higher, but that would be a situation which would support Beijing and potentially cause it to more overtly support Russia.
Thank you. Those are really great insights. Let us perhaps also look at countries that may have increased their leverage and might even have directly benefited from the recent and ongoing turbulence. Three countries that might be worth mentioning in this context are Turkey, Qatar, and also India. So could you perhaps discuss a bit how and why certain countries been able to improve their position?
Sure. So, India, I think, has played this very well as, you know, a longstanding country that doesn't want to be forced into the West and the East, one of the few areas of policy overlap between the historically dominant Congress Party and the BJP of current Indian Prime Minister Modi. For India, that really has a large part to do with its position as the bulwark against China and the sort of key node for Western efforts to build up an alternate alliance system in or at least partnership system in Asia, opposed to Beijing. India has benefited from cheap oil, for example, as a result, but I see it more as a result of India's under-recognized geopolitical strength rather than necessarily itself enhancing India's geopolitical strength. With Qatar, one of the main points that I make in the book is that gas markets weren't globalized in the way they are today in 2014. So in 2014, if there was a gas price spike in the United States, the impact on the European market was almost zero, and changes in Chinese demand also had very little impact. Whereas today, in large part through the development of the liquefied natural gas sector, gas markets are truly global. And Europe, of course, has had to resort to LNG imports from other markets to replace the Russian gas, as well as some more piped gas from Algeria and Azerbaijan in particular. But Qatar is the world's sort of leading LNG hub, although it was overtaken by production by the United States. I think that its control of gas supplies will put it in the position to be the true geoeconomic power of the Middle East going forward, much the way that Saudi Arabia has been in historical oil prices. And that's also, not to hawk too much on the point, but Saudi Arabia, MBS, despite his track record and legacy, he has also played this particularly well through the OPEC Plus partnership and positioning Saudi Arabia as the sort of indispensable country for the West to blunt the threat from Putin's oil weapon, because Putin could still at some point say, I'm willing to shut off my oil exports to deal with, say the price cap until you agree to do it, and to try to drive oil prices up to $200. And I'm not saying I know what MBS would decide, but the only country that would really be able to have the ability to blunt that impact or to sharpen it is Saudi Arabia. So despite his track record and despite, for example, U.S. President Biden calling him a pariah during the 2020 campaign, now U.S. officials are going to Saudi Arabia and talking friendly. And we've now seen reporting at the upcoming G20 summit, they're due to announce some new joint investment efforts. And then finally, Turkey. Erdogan has played this very delicately by keeping one foot in each camp. A lot of domestic dynamics in Turkey played a role in that, including the coup attempt and the conflict in Syria. It was not 6 years ago that tensions between Turkey and Russia were at their all-time high, and we actually saw Turkey call for Article 4 consultations about Russia after the shootdown of a Russian plane for violating its airspace, and sort of tensions with that. And then, of course, Turkey's decision to buy the S-400 air defense system in violation is maybe a strong word, but in contravention of the spirit, certainly, of the U.S. sanctions program at the time. You know, I think that Turkey's position in between the two has seen it reap certain benefits. You know, we've seen Turkey over the last year and a half get money directly from Russia. We've seen it now change its macroeconomic policy, which probably would have been more terminal if it wasn't for that Russian financial support and support from a number of other regional countries as well. But now we've seen Erdogan, of course, reverse ferret, adopt the traditional monetary policy, move to allow Sweden into NATO. And lo and behold, the World Bank, which is, you know, a UN institution, but as I pointed out in the book, the World Bank and IMF as UN institutions are in Washington, D.C. for a reason, rather than New York or Geneva, as the other UN institutions where the U.S. has veto power, is now in talks to, you know, give another $18 billion, essentially doubling its existing investment and credit support for the Turkish economy. I do worry that Erdogan, in particular, because of how strategically important the country is in part playing with fire, and that this position, you know, may not prove tenable over the long run. But again, without this being a comment on his democratic tendencies or lack thereof, you know, I think we sometimes underestimate Erdogan as a effective, you know, doesn't mean good, but effective wheeler and dealer in international politics. But I certainly think the risks are still pronounced to Turkey from this, and it's done a very good job of juggling the fire, but, you know, all it has to do is drop the ball once for it to potentially be quite cataclysmic.
You state in the book that Ukraine received the largest amount of Western financial support granted in a single year, just last year, and that the attempt to incapacitate the Russian economy quickly led to the latter's default, which is in fact likely to have an impact for many years to come. So how do you view the future place of Russia in the international economic order, not least in connection with its recent default?
So Russia will broadly be cut out from the order for the foreseeable future. There will be some changes at the margin, and we even see that now. For example, you know, just earlier this week, you know, one of Putin's major steps in the initial aftermath of the sanctions was to say, well, we're going to seize all the Western planes that are here. You know, about 180 were seized, but just 2 days ago, the Russian state admitted they had to pay $600 million and have already paid it for 18 of them. So, you know, there will still be, you know, attempts to try to keep it going. That means that Russia can now fly those Boeing aircraft that it seized abroad, but of course it still can't legally get repairs for them from Boeing and the other suppliers because of the sanctions on dual use and commercial aviation technology. The default is a very important point to highlight. Russia, in the guise of the Soviet Union, has experience with this, and that, you know, the Soviet Union in its first 4 months of existence defaulted on the Tsarist debts and actually remained in default all the way until 1998 on some of them. Back then, there were some resumptions of credit from the Western market in the 1930s, and then, of course, with Lend-Lease. But in the modern era, where there's so much investor power over these, there will be lawsuits against Russia resulting from that for the foreseeable future. Anytime Russia, you know, even if there were a peace agreement and it tried to come back in, it would need to cure that default before it could really re-enter the Western financial system. And then, of course, sanctions are much easier to impose than they are to lift. So the threat of and the long-lasting impacts of the sanctions on Russia's central bank and on its SWIFT access, its access of its banks to the standard messaging system used between financial institutions around the world, will remain constrained for the foreseeable future. You know, that's not to say that any one of these individual components is going to be what dooms the Russian economy going forward. But the way that, you know, I sort of like to describe it is that as a result of sanctions, you know, Russia is essentially an economy with a terminal disease. Now, because it still has some support from China, and because of its oil and gas importance, those effectively serve as medicines that can help manage the spread of that disease and manage how quickly it is terminal. And it may be for a very long time still that that medicine provides palliative care. But an actual cure from that economic disease only exists in the form of the end of the Putin regime. And I'm not saying that I foresee that imminently, but just as it took, you know, many years, even after the Soviet collapse, for Russia to re-enter the international economic order, it won't be something that happens overnight, even if Putin were to get, you know, hit by a lightning strike tomorrow either.
Thank you so much for that substantial answer and for the entire conversation today, Max.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. It was a real pleasure. And I hope your listeners will get a chance to read the book. If they're in the U.S., they can order it from Oxford University Press with the code ADISTA. 15 for a discount. And if they're in Europe, they can order it from the European publisher, which is Hearst Publishers, with the code HESS25 for a 25% discount there.
The pleasure has been all mine. Thank you so much for that recommendation. I have been discussing with Maximilian Hess today, whose new book is titled Economic War, Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. I hope you have enjoyed our conversation about it. Until the next conversation here at the Review of Democracy.